We are in a, I'm doing a little two-week apologetic series here. Last week we looked at the Bible, and how do we know that we have the Bible today is what they had then, and I looked at the evidence of ancient manuscripts and archaeology. If you're interested in that, or if you have any doubts about, you know, the Bible's authenticity, I would highly recommend you go online and get the message. You can download your own messages, by the way. You can burn them to your own CD, no charge. We'd love you to get them out there. But that was last week. This week we're going to look at the second hot topic I want to do about evolution and whether or not evolution is true. And just then we're going to wrap up this apologetics and we're going to get back to our some messages out of the scripture. This debate between evolutionists or intelligent design creationists, origin of life, it's a hotly contested issue, and I don't have to tell you that. You know that. There's intellectuals quarrel over it, educators fight over it, even car symbols battle over it, you know, the Darwin sticker, you know, versus the creation fish, you know, it's pretty classic stuff out there. Recently, there's been several news stories about school districts battling over the intelligent design debate, and it's created really a firestorm of response out there, and I'm going to explain that as I kind of go through this morning. What's going on? I hope to give you kind of a bird's eye view of this whole discussion. I do want you to understand this and explain it up front, that the real battleground, though it's positioned differently in the media, is really not over Bible and science. You will see that as we conclude today. But hold that thought. There's another battleground out there, really. And the real battle is what Harvard graduate and 30-year law professor Philip Johnson. Philip Johnson wrote the book, Darwin on Trial, Defeating Darwinism, Reason in the Balance. Philip there, I call him Philip Bulldog Johnson, he is a Harvard and University of Chicago graduate, law clerk one time years ago for Chief Justice Earl Warren. And he had a 30-year tenure as a law professor at UC Berkeley, of all places. And he's a professor emeritus there. And this is the battle, okay, that you have to understand before I get into this whole topic today. Philip Johnson says it well in his book, Defeating Darwinism. He says, the evolutionary naturalists rely upon cultural stereotypes to shut off all criticism of their philosophy. And that stereotype that they rely on portrays all opponents, anybody who's against the evolutionary theory, as extreme Genesis literalists who reject the evidence of science, here's the key, for purely religious reasons. So the battle is positioned this way in the evolution creation or evolution intelligent design debate. Anybody who's not on board with evolution rejects good science and is doing it for nonsensical, non-factual reasons. They're just doing it for purely religious reasons. That is the stereotype you fall into if you're going to question science at any point for being good science. He says, as long as the conflict is perceived this way, the grave scientific defects, and there are, in the ruling theory of evolution, and the philosophical bias that sustains it, can be effectively concealed from view. So what the media does is kind of spin it as a religious, you know, they're bringing religion back into the schools, okay? Well, let me give you a case in point. Danny Phillips, at the time, was a 15-year-old high school junior in the Denver area. His class was assigned to watch that Nova film, Miracle of Life. And in that movie, or that film, Miracle of Life, they categorically state the story of evolution from molecule to man as a complete fact. And so Danny knows that that went way beyond the scientific evidence. And so he wrote a paper to the school administration exposing the Nova program for at least being propaganda, in the sense that it tried to portray something as factual that wasn't factual. His argument was so well presented that the administrators who initially agreed, you know what, you've got a good point, initially. But the fact that they were seriously considering questioning this Nova program brought on dissent and a maelstrom of protests that was so venomous in the Denver area and that the editorial page editor to the Denver Post said, my own liberal faith has completely been shaken. And she wrote these words, they will sting a bit, that these defenders of intellectual freedom, meaning those who were on the side of evolution, behaved, in fact, just like a bunch of conservative Christians. Theirs was a different kind of fundamentalism, but no less dogmatic and no less tolerant. Now, Danny's story later appeared on a national TV, CBS television special, And they brought in an experienced Darwinist debater named Eugenia Scott, who was careful, now catch this, go back to this cultural stereotype that Philip Johnson talks about, to cast Annie in a certain light. She, as an opponent, actually, of education. She said, if Danny Phillips doesn't want to learn evolution, that's his own business. But his views should not prevail for 80,000 students who need to learn evolution to be educated. Are you catching that? You don't learn evolution, you're not educated. That's the basis. So, because he's opposing the science of the show, Danny is an enemy of education. Well, Danny was just opposing science with science. Now, Danny went on to speak, but CBS didn't cover it. They cut off after Eugenia Scott. What Danny had to say was only recorded in his local newspaper in Denver. He said, students' minds are to be kept open and not limited to a set of beliefs. Doesn't that sound like something that someone would say about religious beliefs trying to take over? He's saying, you've got a set of beliefs here that you're not allowing anybody to challenge based on the facts. He goes on to say, I object to the teaching of evolution as factual. I wanted to stop something that was not just against my religious beliefs, but something that wasn't good science. Now, I want you to note, he never said he objected to evolution being taught as theory. In fact, he was okay as long as you're willing to say, well, we think that this is how it might work out. Theory. So recognize that the battle isn't the Bible versus science, but really something far more insidious. Who's going to have the power? Who's going to have the control to push their agenda forward? And I just want to tell you, we're here to talk about science in the sense of how God would view it, and is it right or is it wrong? In fact, in a phrase, this morning I'm going to work on heightening your baloney detectors and hopefully make you a little more cognizant of how things get spun in this world and why they get spun that way. Now, where did we come from? On one hand, virtually every science textbook in America and every public school institution, even going back to my era, talked about the theory of evolution as the means by which life originated and developed on Earth. You only need to listen to what's being taught in our universities and even our high schools sometimes to understand the intimidation you might feel if you begin to oppose this evolutionary standard. Richard Dawkins is professor at Oxford University. His claim is, if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is either ignorant, stupid, or insane. That simple. Cornell University biology professor William Provine, he's a leader in his field. He tells his students, the world is organized strictly with mechanistic principles. There is no purpose, there are no gods, there are no designing forces. There are no inherent moral or ethical laws, which, let me translate for you, means there's nothing wrong with murder unless society decides there's something wrong with murder. There is no absolute principle that says wrong to murder. Because there are no absolute principles for human society. When you die, and that is the end of you. That attitude pervades every secular institution in America. That is the mantra of evolutionary naturalism. You cannot watch a show on TV, Animal Planet, PBS, Discovery Channel, without hearing some claim about evolution. Now, I want to make this disclaimer before we continue this morning. The basic presupposition of evolution, of course, is atheistic. There is no God. There are many devout followers of God, including well-trained and respected Christian theologians, who believe in a form of something called theistic evolution. That is the idea that God was there to get the ball rolling and allowed some things to take place. Most of that is what you would call microevolution, which was then certain species things did happen. But in the sense that one species translated from one to another, from a molecule to man, didn't happen. Although there are a few Christians that believe that still. I'm not going to deal with that. What I'm going to deal with is this predominant naturalistic view, definition, that the forces of nature alone are adequate to explain everything that exists. Now, the Bible says this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It makes that statement. It goes on to explain that in a little more detail. Carl Sagan, who passed away 3 years ago, wrote The Cosmos, you know, is very famous in the naturalistic scientific world, says, we don't think so. In fact, one of his famous quotes, Sagan says, we've explained it all. There's nothing left for God to do. Why believe in God except for sentimental reasons? And Heinz Pagels, another scientist, said, there is no scientific evidence for a creator, no evidence of a will or purpose. All can be accounted for by evolution. In other words, your existence is really pointless. There is no purpose to life, but we have told you how it all happens. Now, supporters of evolution are dogmatic in their claim that the evidence lies on their side. That's this propaganda wheel is pumped at us all the time. I'm going to evidence this for you today. I'm kind of curious, as if God did evidence something, how they would take it outside of the box of naturalism. I don't know. The reason that intelligent design is not even debated in these circles is because it's outside this box. And this is what you have to understand. First of all, we're put into a cultural stereotype as just being lunatics, right? So if you object to something factual from a scientific basis, they cast you all the way into lunacy. But over here is this box of naturalism that just says, we define the terms of life. So by the mere definition of how life came into being, there is no room for any other input but, because of the definition, but evolution. So it has to fit in that model. Anything to suggest it doesn't fit in that model, intelligent design, special creative force, or whatever, you guys are nuts. It's not even allowed to be looked at. So you'll see that as we go along. Now, scientist Chris LaRocca, I'm going to start this thing here, said one of the most persistently asked questions is how and when was the universe created? He said, and this is true, many once believed the universe had no beginning, no end, it was truly infinite. In other words, matter was always eternal in a naturalistic viewpoint, even in a spiritual viewpoint. Yeah, matter was eternal, it was always here. And basically the difference between a naturalist and a believer would be, well, we believe that there was an intelligence behind that matter, and they say no, matter just was, okay? But something happened, and he says, through the inception of this Big Bang theory. You know, see, naturalistic philosophy said that life was this unbroken chain that went just back billions of years or whatever and found a way to develop by natural processes. That's a naturalistic worldview. Somewhere in the early 20th century, lines of evidence began to converge that led in 1960s, and I remember this when it came out. I was in, junior high. The formation of this Big Bang theory. And I remember it being discussed. What was the significance of the Big Bang? Well, science itself now says that the universe actually did burst into existence at a particular time in a remote past. Don't ask me to explain to you how. But they, you know, they're using good science, completely overruling this earlier theory that matter was eternal. LaRocca continues, he says, science has now told us that the universe is in fact finite, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. By the way, you only have 22 more minutes before the universe ends. I got some inside scoop. Anyway, so what's he saying? He's saying the universe would pop into existence, it would have some time to exist, and then the universe, all that we understand about a universe, would end. Compare that scientific statement with this, which is found in the Bible, a biblical explanation in the book of Hebrews. Lord, in the beginning you said you laid the foundations for the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. God brought it into existence. But even they will perish, but you will remain forever. It's just like, whoa. It kind of just right in sync with what the Big Bang Theory teaches. That it came into being, it has a time period, it's finite, it is going to end. You know, that's where the law of second thermodynamics is, everything's wearing down. Well, obviously God knew that when he made it. He's going to recreate it all. Now, I want to take you to another thing called the anthropic principle. Anthropic principle states that in our universe, all these seemingly unrelated values in physics have one strange thing in common. All these values that they've been able to study, they're all interrelated. What's the thing in common? I'll read it for you. They are precisely the values needed to get a universe capable of supporting life. And these values only happen here on Earth. So in a glitch in any one of these things, there is no life. You and I don't exist. Nothing exists. If the Earth rotated slower or faster, if there were 2% closer or further from the sun, we had a 1% change in the sunlight, we were smaller or larger as a planet, the moon was smaller or larger, extra moon or not, Earth's crust was thicker or thinner, the oxygen-nitrogen ratio was greater or less, ozone layer was greater or less, and this one surprised me, actually, if Denny's didn't stay up for 24 hours. I didn't know that. All life would cease to exist. Now, what's the point? Well, this again kind of lends itself, this anthropic principle does lend itself for someone, I think, reasonably to suggest, you know, there looks like there's some intelligent design to why this is all happening. Now, there's a whole other field that, you know, we've dealt with over the years. It's these scientific discoveries and or experiments. One of the biggest that happened back in the 50s was Dr. Stanley Miller created life forms in a test tube He did this by mixing simple chemicals and gases in this glass tube, and when he zapped them with an electrical charge, and I'm way oversimplifying what he did, he induced chemical reactions, which, and what emerged on the other side of those reactions were amino acids, okay? They weren't there before. They were there after. What that seemed to point to is this dramatic evidence for this naturalistic account of the origin of life, that this matter was always there, the gases were there, the simple chemicals were there, an electrical charge took some place in the universe at some time after the Big Bang, and boom, life began its process over billions of years. Here was the problem. Amino acids come in two forms. Somebody else will have to explain this to me. They're left-handed and right-handed amino acids. Living things are highly selective. They can only survive using left-handed forms of amino acids. Miller's test tube test experiment produced a 50-50 ratio of left and right. In fact, what they've discovered, even today, every time amino acids are randomly mixed, this is the result. And there is no natural process that we've discovered anywhere in the universe that produces only left-handed acids. So all this means is that the amino acids formed randomly in a test tube, either by experiment or by a natural process, are useless for life. But that's only the first problem. The next step, because life is very intricate, is to get these amino acids to link up to form proteins. Now, they kind of link up in a Tinker Toy type thing, if you've ever seen those pictures, in ways to connect them. But they never hooked up in a test tube randomly to produce a viable proteins. None of the proteins were viable for life. None. And then there's another side to this, a third side. In order for the protein once formed, if it is viable, to function, there must be a particular sequence to the acids as they hook up, or the protein created will also be a non-functional protein. But in the random process, these protein chains created by natural process, they were useless for life. So you don't hear that. You just kind of hear, hey, we created life in a test tube, but by the way, it really isn't life. It was a cool experiment. It showed some things that they didn't know, but it really didn't produce the building blocks for life. Now, even the most successful origin of life's experiments tell us nothing about what really could happen under natural conditions. What we see, it only tells us what happens when a very educated, very intelligent scientist manipulates a process, coaxes materials down the chemical pathways that's necessary to produce these building blocks, which seems to prove what? Somebody's using some intelligent design to make these experiments work. It isn't a random, natural process in any way, shape, or form. Now, on the screen behind you is a picture of Mount St. Helens. You know, May 18th, 1980. Man, can you believe it's been that long ago? The eruption of Mount St. Helens, once this beautiful symmetrical cone volcano, was covered by old growth trees, 150 to 200 feet tall trees in this mountain up in Washington. In an explosion, which they said, initial explosion, which was the equivalent of 20 million tons of TNT or 1,500 atomic bombs going off at once, Mount St. Helens and the surrounding area was changed forever. Now listen to this, a lot of people don't know this. You think of the big first explosion, right? Mount St. Helens continued to erupt for 15 hours after the initial explosion, with a force that they've measured at 400 million tons of TNT, or 30,000 atomic bombs. Basically, what happened at Mount St. Helens is that the equivalent of one atom bomb exploded every second for 15 straight hours. Every second. That's how much force. This was a huge mountain, and then that, okay? Huge mountain, and then that. Just, it took it apart. Now, what's the point of Mount St. Helens? Well, geologists used to believe layers of volcanic rock were set apart by vast amounts of time. What Mount St. Helens proved to the world was that sediment is laid down in multiple layers in matters of hours. In fact, the lava ash flow from Mount St. Helens was 550 degrees Fahrenheit, moved at 200 miles an hour down the sides of the mountain. It took with it 150 square miles of timber in a matter of 6 minutes. Paul Bunyan would have been envious. 20,000 rootless trees were deposited into that lake near there called Spirit Lake. Remember Harry Truman, the guy named after our president, who said, I ain't leaving, and he got liquidated. And those trees ended up in Spirit Lake, and they got waterlogged, and they sank, some upright, some sideways, some on top of each other, and they're buried deeply in multiple layers. Now, how many of you have ever been to Yellowstone? Anybody here ever been to Yellowstone? A few of you. How many of you recognize the name Specimen Ridge at Yellowstone? Anybody know that? Remember that? Specimen Ridge in Yellowstone, for years, had a sign up that detailed the 27 layers of forest which scientists claim were deposited over millions of years. In this ridge line were these petrified trees. And here's an example of how you see one of those petrified trees actually in the ridge line, in the layers, right? And what they told us, at least on the sign that was out there, is that these layers have been built up over time and different evolutionary processes taking place over great periods of time. Well, guess what? The 27 layers of trees in Yellowstone look exactly like how the trees are deposited at Spirit Lake by Mount St. Helens in a matter of minutes and layered. They look identical. They've taken the sign down. Because I think they now think, well, Specimen Ridge is just like another Mount St. Helens. It was a cataclysmic event that took place. That was their science at that point. Got disproved. But that was a huge thing. That Mount St. Helens shows that, you know, a big, large event can do in a moment what theory said it took millions and maybe billions of years to accomplish. Interesting. Gets better. Now, almost all of us grew up, or who's ever taken a high school biology class, was led to believe that the fossil record contains ironclad proof for evolution and that the fossils are an embarrassment to anybody that would believe in creation, because it really proves that we've evolved and transitioned through all these life forms from molecule to man over 5 billion years. Now, the Bible says that God created the world and introduced fully developed species that have continued to reproduce according to their own kind. It's the Bible's description of how life formed here on Earth. It was created, introduced as fully formed species. The fossil record says, no, it started back here, single cell, moved all the way up through billions of years, and we finally came up with man. Now, we all opened those biology books and saw this thing called the Tree of Life. And it was showing how fossils prove life evolved through all these gradual changes. And the Darwinian evolutionist believes that this is what they would find in the fossil record, a record and a continual record of gradual, continuous change. And strong evidence in the fossil record for that. If the Bible account is true, we would expect to find the fossil record to contain sudden appearances of life forms rather than these transitional forms from species growing along. Now, which one of these models is actually supported in the fossil record? Well, this on the screen behind you is a fossil. Nobody denies that, you know, there are fossils out there. Everybody admits that fossils exist. And I'm going to put a lot of quotes on the screen in the next few minutes from respected scientists and leaders in their field. They are not from pastors. They're not from Christian scientists. They are not from philosophers. All the quotes I'm using are from non-Christian, non-believing, atheistic scientists. In fact, most of these quotes come from their college textbooks. Now, Stephen Stanley of Johns Hopkins University is a leading paleontologist. He's not a creationist. He says, and I love this quote, the fossil record, and only for the fossil record, provides direct evidence for evolution. Now, the very first fossils of life, according to evolution, are metazoa. They're these multi-celled little creatures. They're very complex. Where did they come from? Well, they appear suddenly in the fossil record with no ancestors. In a textbook called Introduction to Evolution, Paul Moody admits a fossil record of their history has not yet been found. They appear suddenly. What about the origin of Cambrian animals? All of a sudden, in the Cambrian period, there's an abundance of life in the fossils. The oceans are teeming with all kinds of life, very complex life. Where did all these animals come from? They are advanced life forms that must have taken millions of years to develop, according to a naturalist. Surely, at some point, there would be other fossils that would be shown to demonstrate where these guys came from. But as one paleontologist puts it, one of the major problems of evolution is the occurrence of diversified multicellular marine invertebrates in the lower Cambrian rocks and the absence in the rocks of a greater age. In other words, we've got them here. Why aren't they down here? Where's the developmental process? Their high degree of complexity clearly indicates that a long period of evolution preceded their appearance, but they're not there. When we turn to examine the forerunners of these fossils, they are nowhere to be found. What about the move from invertebrate to vertebrate marine animals? In other words, what we would call fish. This is John's favorite part of the message. N.J. Birrell wrote a book called The Origin of Vertebrates. And he talks about how gills and spines and eyes and evolved. But then he gives this disclaimer after he tells this whole story about how this allegedly happened. There is no direct proof or evidence that any of the suggested events, which I just wrote about, or changes ever took place. In this sense, the account is science fiction. How they evolved, what stages of development it went through, eventually giving rise to fish-like creatures, we do not know. And then he actually says, there's a gap which we'll perhaps never be able to fill. What about the next major transition, fish to amphibians? They have developed different skin, different eyes, tongues, different mouths, lungs, a lot of adaptive change. Long years for these fossils of the transitions to form in the rock. But listen to evolutionist Gordon Taylor. There are no intermediate forms between fin and limb creatures in the fossil collections of the world. Once again, the evidence for gradual evolution is missing. Another evolution, Alfred Romer says, we lack transitional forms to bridge the gap. These are in their textbooks. The modern amphibians appear in the fossil record without transitions and are essentially modern in appearance. Now, back on April 6th, the Tribune ran an article, it's a national story on the AP Wire, on this new fish fossil discovered in the Arctic Circle called Tiltaalik, named after the Eskimo name for some kind of fish. Scientists are now calling this fish fossil the missing link of the sea to amphibian movement. Okay? Fish to amphibians. Now, never mind that since we've got gajillions of everything else, that we should have conjillions of this too, right? But we don't. I mean, this is part of this whole thing that's really mind-boggling. Because of the box, it is evolution. All we need is one fossil. I would say, no, don't we need like a million of them? You know, to show that these life forms were there? No, we just need something that looks like it's in between this and this, and then we know we got a missing link. And I like the quote of Neil Shubin, the guy at the University of Chicago who discovered this thing. He goes, listen to this for authority. This sort of blurs the distinction between fish and land-living animals. And so, again, it's being squeezed in. Now, there's something else I got to tell you about this. With this intelligent design debate that's really hot in the school district all over the country, I don't know if you've noticed in the newspapers, but these evolutionary stories are popping up all the time. New fossil find, new fossil find, new fossil find, new fossil find. It's all over the internet. And the creationist guys, scientists on there are saying, I'm telling you what, they're going, this is part of damage control right now. They're fighting back. They're trying to say, no, 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 you're an idiot if you believe in anything but what we believe. We are finding the missing links, I'm telling you, is what they're trying to say. Listen to what evolutionist, non-believer, Jennifer Clark from Cambridge University, that's got some renown, said about this thing that was just discovered. It's impossible to tell if Tiltaalik was a direct ancestor of vertebrates. You know, conjecture, conjecture, conjecture to what? To keep the party line running. I'm telling you, these things are not ironclad as the newspaper and the titles and the lines make them seem to be. We're going to look at another one when we get to the origin of man here in a moment. But let's go back to the origin of reptiles, which follows amphibians. This change from amphibian to reptile, this is a major innovation in vertebrate history. Gordon Taylor, again, the evolutionist, says, how and when did the change occur? We don't know. Just when we need that fossil record, it's blank. They just appear again. What about the origin of birds? They came from reptiles. I don't know if you saw Jurassic Park. Remember, that was the twist in the first Jurassic Park, was those dinosaurs evolved into birds. Remember, because he's looking at the plane, the birds flying by the plane. That was that kind of spin. Well, they came from reptiles, is what we're told. W.E. Swinton. He's a naturalist. He was, at one time, the head guy of the British Museum of Natural History, which has since changed its name to the Natural History Museum, which is, by the way, command central of the Darwinian theory. He said the origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which remarkable change from reptiles to birds was achieved. We have reptiles and we have birds. Note that he doesn't say there are a few. The odd thing is there are so many adaptations required to go from a reptile to a bird. I mean, this is just mind-boggling. Required the development of the feathers, new bone structure, ability to regulate temperature. You'd think there'd be some fossils. Gordon Taylor says, of the changes, the most radical and the most baffling is the thermal regulation that birds have. It's their heating mechanism. It appears full-fledged on the evolutionary scene with as little warning as devil in pantomime. Suddenly, bang, there are birds. Now, I grew up hearing about this little fellow here, Archaeopteryx, I believe. He was supposed to be the transitional form from reptiles to birds. But Squinton says even about this guy, unfortunately not. Again, this is what happens when they declare these missing links. This was way back, and they came through, and they said, well, it's really had some reptilian-looking features, but it also had every feature associated with the modern birds, feathers, light-weighted bones, everything. In fact, they have determined it is a bird, not a fraudulent fossil, but a bird. That's all. Now, what about the origin of mammals? Moody says in his textbook on evolution, apparently the transition to mammals occurred in the late Jurassic. Somewhere in that Jurassic period, mammals appeared. Unfortunately, the fossil record is most fragmentary at this point. Yes, unfortunate indeed. How fragmentary? Well, the beginning of the Mammalian story is rather different and even more obscure than those just described. More than a dozen essentially modern groups appear, get that, in the fossil record. From that time, almost all the familiar modern groups, from rabbits to tigers, from anteaters to bats, are rather common. What would explain the sudden appearance of so many new lines is a puzzle unlikely ever to be solved. Hold that thought when I get to Francis Crick at the end of this message in just a few minutes, okay? Puzzle ever to be solved, because one guy tries to solve it without God. Now, you might be thinking, well, this is only because the fossil evidence is fragmentary. It's just the way it works out there. We've got these sudden appearances, and for some reason, all the transitory forms just evaporated. Well, if we only had one place where we could dig up a lot of things, we'd see these transitions. Well, they do. It's called the Bighorn Basin in Wyoming. It offers just that. And according to Stephen Stanley, he says, the fossil record at Bighorn does not convincingly document a single transition from one species to another. They're all their own life forms appearing suddenly in the fossil record. He says, the elephant appear abruptly, almost simultaneously, and once formed, they retain their basic body plans for something like 500,000 generations. You know, what do we say? Everything's according to its own kind. Gordon Taylor points out the same phenomena. Even more recent evolutionary changes are baffling, says Gordon. For instance, whales and dolphins appear in the fossil record fully formed and diversified. Appear. G.G. Simpson, ardent Darwinist, concedes the point. He says, in all 32 orders of mammals, the break is so sharp, the gap so large that the origin of each order is very speculative. Where did they come from? But they say there's an origin, and it's evolved, but we just don't know where it's at. Now, what about the origin of man? Is there a fossil record? Now, Moody says we encounter an unfortunate gap. It's just over and over. I will give these scientists this. I am not mocking them at all. These guys are brilliant. They call a spade, but they hold to the party line. You know what I'm saying? We do not have fossils of possible human ancestors living in the later portions of the Pliocene. What we do have are fossils of beings that are clearly ape-like and beings that are clearly lifelike humans. No transitory fossils. Now, if you read the paper in the last couple weeks, we saw this new fossil links up human evolution. In this article, which is in the Tribune I have, and it was also National News, USA Today, everybody had the same article, same thing. New fossil links up human evolution. The guy goes and says, now we have it. One place where we see the whole panorama of human evolution from point A to point Z. It's all here. It's now final. I'm reading this, I'm going, what? I mean, that's a bold statement. So I read the whole article, and what basically we find is that picture there on your right is a picture of the bones that they found in this Ethiopian dig. And they found other bones in this Ethiopian dig over the years. It's this mile-high wash. Okay, goes on for 3 miles or something. This are bones from a creature that they have called Australopithecus. And we have already had bones of Australopithecus. So it's not a new fossil. It's a new fossil in the sense that we didn't have this Australopithecus fossil. Okay? And it was found in proximity to an older version that was called Ardipithecus. Okay? So what they're saying, because they're close in proximity, and this is all part of the scientific thing, that there's evidence that the link from Ardipithecus to Australopithecus took place. Here it is, right here. We got it. Okay? That's the line. In the article, it says, this just blows my mind, while it's looking more likely, it's not a sure thing that Ardipithecus evolved in Australopithecus. I'm like, well, what are you saying over here? I mean, which one is it? I'm telling you, this is the Kool-Aid, boys and girls, that we're being made to drink. And they believe it. They believe it with all their hearts. It's called macroevolution. There is no God. There is no room for anything else but no God and naturalistic evolution. I am using their words. Okay? That's what I'm trying to tell you here. I'm not trying to get you out there and beat people up with this information. I'm trying to go, oh, so that's how this thing's happening. I'll expose you a little more. Listen, just a couple more minutes. Origin of plants. Botanical evolutionary theory is mainly unsupported by fossil evidence. How unsupported? From what group did they evolve? Nobody knows where the plants came from. They just showed up on the scene, dang it. The absence of transitional forms is an almost universal phenomenon. The line making the connection with common ancestry is not known in even one instance. Now, when PBS did that Nova show I told you about earlier, Miracle of Life, where they talked about evolution is a proven fact, and that's what Danny Phillips, you know, wrote against. I will give them this. They added this disclaimer, and I give them credit for this at the end of the show. Because they're honest. They're trying to be honest. They're just stuck in the box. For paleontologists who have dedicated careers to confirming Darwin's career, and catch that, dedicated careers to confirming, this is our life mission and purpose, the fossil record is discouragingly void of transitional forms that might explain the progression from one species to the next. No explicit examples of the kind of evolution Darwin predicted between species have shown up. The record is filled with gaps or missing links that seem to undermine his theory. Niles Eldridge, who wrote a book on evolution, a believer in the theory, even he had to admit this. We paleontologists have said that the history of life supports the story of gradual adaptive change, all the while really knowing that it does not. Stephen Jay Gould, probably the most famous paleontologist of our time, says, in the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record is the trade secret of paleontology. Now, let me just say this. I was on websites all week long. I'm looking at the creation websites. I'm getting some information, but I was mostly on their stuff. And I'm telling you, it felt evil. Not just reading their stuff, but the let's see what the creationists are going to say about this fossil find. You know, and I can hear the creationists going, let's show these guys what we know about real science. You know, there's this real antagonism between the two groups. And there shouldn't be, at least from our side. Do not, based on this evidence of no transitional forms, ever go to somebody and say, you know what? There are no transitional forms. Wake up, man. You know? Because that's not how they see it. There are some candidates, though they are highly dubious candidates for transition. It's best to say something like this. This is your application. While Darwin predicted that the fossil record would show numerous, and the key word is numerous, transitional fossils, even 140 years later, all we have are a handful of disputable examples. Very disputable examples. Now I want to introduce you to Dean Kenyon. He's a chairman and dean of the biology department and professor at San Francisco State University. What made him famous was he published a book about how non-organic molecules could have evolved into living molecules in the primordial soup. Okay? And what happened was, he was teaching his book, and the more he studied it, and the more honest he was with himself, he goes, what I wrote isn't true. Now listen, you've got to listen carefully to what he's saying here. Because he talks about what happens when he stopped drinking the Kool-Aid, too. All right? Go ahead and hit the lights, and we'll listen to him.
I would say I was a convinced neo-Darwinist and a chemical evolutionist. It became increasingly difficult for me to provide examples of actually observed evolutionary change for my students. Unfortunately, I am not allowed to discuss these topics in my courses here at San Francisco State. I think that the more we learn in molecular biology and the more we learn from chemical evolution studies, the less likely is it that the chemical evolution explanation is going to turn out to be the right one.
He basically was a scientist that wasn't a believer that just basically said, you know, guys, this isn't true. And you know what? He started pointing out to his class, a couple of his students complained because they were drinking the Kool-Aid. And the dean of the college brought him in and said, you know what? You're gone. He said, what do you mean I'm gone? What am I gone for? And he said, well, you're teaching creationism. He says, no, I'm not. He says, you're a Genesis literalist. And he goes, no, I'm not. And he says, tell me what I'm doing wrong that you want to fire me for. I am questioning my own science in the book that I wrote. Never gave him an answer. Even to this day, you can read an article on him on the internet. He says, they've never given me an answer as to why they fired me for teaching what I found out about my own work that wasn't true. It was science, pure science. I don't know if Dean Kenyon's a believer or not. He's on his way. Now, you're probably listening to all this and going on, why does anybody believe so dogmatic in evolution? Well, you know, there's a lot of good science in naturalism. But like I said, there's that box out there. But I love what evolutionist D.M. Watson said. Evolution is accepted not because it can be proven by logical, coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, and this is the key, is special creation. It's clearly incredible. What he's saying there is, you guys are asking us to believe in God. You got to be asking us to believe that we should have a foot growing out of our forehead. You know, it's just not the way it's going to be. So what do naturalist scientists do with all this data, ones that want to be honest with the perspective? Well, they either shut up because they don't dare challenge the orthodoxy. I had a scientist came and told me today after 9 o'clock service, as I walked out, he goes, 15 years I spent in this field. I forgot molecular biology he was in. And he says, you know what? It's a buddy-buddy club. The day you speak up, you are out, and you are seen as a nutcase. You do not, you know, try to quench the party line. Well, so some guys who definitely are not believers have come up with other challenges to the orthodoxy, or they come up with what we call non-Darwinian explanations for evolution. One is Francis Crick, who is one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA, just brilliant guy. He says there is extreme difficulty in explaining how life evolved in the time that it had on Earth and the fact that there's a lack of evidence. But he refuses to believe that there's a God, there's some supernatural explanation for life. So he has coined a term he says he believes in that's called directed panspermia. This is the basic idea that an advanced extraterrestrial civilization, possibly facing extinction, sent primitive life forms to Earth in a spaceship. Movie Mission to Mars about 8-10 years ago. That's what that story was all about. Okay? Now go back to when I was looking at that origin of man, when they're talking about how that, you know, that fossil record doesn't line up and everything just appears suddenly in the fossil record. Well, Crick comes along and says, well, I know there's no God, but you know what? There was some other life form that injected life here, and that's why it appears suddenly in the fossil record. That's what he's saying. And that's, he says, the evidence is there. And he goes, it fits the facts perfectly. It also fits the Bible explanation perfectly. Now, I kid you not, Francis Crick, co-discoverer of DNA, Philip Johnson, my bulldog professor, said, when a scientist of Crick's caliber feels he has to invoke undetectable spacemen, because maybe it's time to consider that life is what it so evidently seems to be, the product of creative intelligence. Now, you know what I believe. I believe there's only one answer for the intricate laws that exist in nature. It's the creation by an all-powerful and all-knowing God. David mentions it many times in his Psalms. And I want to give you, as I close here, 4 scripture verses I want you to ponder. How can this be? How can we be so blinded? Well, Paul gives us a glimpse of this in Ephesians. He says, we need to stand firm against all the strategies and the tricks of the devil. Let me tell you guys, Lucifer is a powerful and real being. He has great intelligence, great power to influence the minds and heart of men. This is what helps you to understand, how can people live in this box? How can people so adamantly oppose God? I'll tell you why. It's impressed upon them by a power and a force greater than themselves, to convince them that they are a god unto themselves and their mind and their reasoning is the champion of the world despite the evidence. And Paul says we are not fighting against such people as Crick or Moody or Gould or any of these guys. We're not. They're fellow human beings. But we're fighting against evil rulers with power in the unseen world, the spiritual world. Paul says that. That's the curtain peeled back about the spiritual warfare that really takes place. You know, I'm not talking about goblins under the chair. I'm just talking about there is a battle spiritually in this universe. God is well aware of it, and he's got it all under control. Okay? But it's out there. And he goes on to say, Satan, Lucifer, the god of this evil world, has blinded the minds of those who don't believe, so they are unable to see the glorious light of the good news that is shining on them. In other words, it's been snatched from them in all actuality. They're close to hearing it. 1 John tells us that the light shines through the darkness and the darkness can never extinguish it. Amen. The light's shining this morning. And the author of Hebrews tells us, by faith we understand the entire universe was formed by God's command. By faith, the evolutionist believes and understands that the entire universe was formed by a naturalistic process. They won't use the word faith. Truth of the matter is their evidence doesn't even work, so you can't even understand it based on their evidence. But they hang to it by faith. Paul says that what we did not see, not Paul didn't write this, we're not sure who wrote Hebrews, it might have been Paul. What we did not see come from anything that can be seen. In other words, God spoke it into existence. That's why we believe what we believe. The evidence seems to be on our side, and there should be some good science there. And hopefully you'll be able to take that with you this morning. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much. Just to be refreshed by knowing that science is not an enemy, but the devil is. And people's minds and hearts are closed off. And I think that the prayer that matters most to us this morning is the one that calls us to remember who we are. It was that song I sang this morning, we all sang, come to that river where we bring our sins. And Lord, how we need you to meet us there. And I'm so grateful, not only for that meeting in my own heart and mind, but for everyone else's here. And Lord, the humility that comes from knowing that you're so loving, so willing to provide a scapegoat for our sin in Jesus, shouldn't make me want to run out there and beat up evolutionists. It should make me want to live humbly, intelligently, thought-provokingly, to speak kindly, reverently, respectfully, to not mock things, but to literally question them with a humble attitude, with understanding. Why? That we might be an example. By serving others, Lord, in a myriad of capacities, we are an example of this truth of who you are in our lives. That's my prayer for us this morning. That we would take to heart what it means to say we're Christians, and that humility and that love that you've given us would become a byproduct of our nature. I pray this in Jesus' name.